Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Tourism in the Cody area hasn't kept up with other Yellowstone Gateway towns. We'll hear how the town is changing up its marketing strategy to reflect that.
People's number one reason they want to come here is not even Yellowstone most months. It actually is all of our outdoor recreation.
Employers in the Cowboy State are getting creative with how they house workers. And for some, that means trucking in homes from factories.
If I hadn't have seen them come in on pieces, I wouldn't really think that they're modulars.
Miss Wyoming talks about the importance of sports and more open conversations about mental health.
We have these resources and it's okay to say, I'm not okay.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us. Do you have a favorite holiday recipe that you make every year around this time? Where did the recipe come from? Who do you make it for? And is there a secret ingredient? We want to hear from you and share your favorite holiday recipe and the story behind it. Leave us a voicemail at 307-766-6626 by Wednesday, December 11th at noon, answering those questions. And we might air it as part of our special holiday-themed Open Spaces.
Find Wyoming Public Radio beyond the airwaves. Check out our website or the Wyoming Public Media app for live streams of your favorite shows, original podcasts, local and Mountain West news, and much more. Find us at wyomingpublicmedia.org or search for Wyoming Public Media in your app store.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. President-elect Donald Trump has pledged a massive crackdown on immigration as soon as he returns to the White House in January. Immigrant advocacy organizations say that while more deportations are looking likely, a slew of legal challenges could also get in the way. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry reports that even before the inauguration, one immigration lawyer in Jackson is barely keeping up.
Ever since Donald Trump won the presidential race, the phones have been ringing at Trifonis Law Center. And Elizabeth Trifonis, the lead attorney and a full-time public defender across the state, says she's had to turn away several people and add them to her wait list.
Come on in. Do you want a cup of coffee or a glass of water?
Starting day one, the president-elect has pledged to deport what could be some of the largest numbers of immigrants in recent history, starting with declaring a national emergency to use the military.
Since the election, I've spent roughly 16-hour days with just people crying in my office and dealing with their trauma and their stress.
Yeah, we have sort of a motto around here that we laugh so we don't cry. So there's a lot of laughter lately. It's almost maniacal at this point, but we keep going.
Many of Trifonis' clients fled their countries of origin to seek asylum. Many have been here for decades, and they're all trying to expedite their applications for legal paperwork. And all are worried that under the Trump administration, they'll be a target if that doesn't go through. It's a lot for Trifonis, who says new clients approach her constantly, even in the parking lot when she's in her pajamas.
I'm exhausted, and frankly, I don't know that I want to do this again. This is not where I thought we would be, and certainly not where I want to continue being at the moment. So I try to not to give my clients doom and gloom, but to prepare them for the reality of things.
Even for those who have been in the system for a while, legalized residency takes time. There are government backlogs and not enough lawyers. Deportations, the risk and the reality are not new. Trump in his first term actually deported fewer people than Obama, Clinton, or Bush. But as Trifonis explains, ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was more predictable under Biden. In Jackson Hole, they'd only go after people with known criminal records. Raids happened rarely. Trifonis' voice gets tight thinking about the first Trump term, when she remembers boots on the ground about every other month. Agents went to businesses and homes, sometimes without warrants. They looked at local news and Facebook profiles to find targets. They'd be in unmarked cars and out of uniform. She warns her clients about being approached on the street, at soccer games, or in the grocery store.
They don't know who they're talking to and are overly polite, and that will end up in that person's arrest.
According to the Jackson Police Department, no one has been deported for a minor crime since the Trump administration.
And under Trump, we don't have any priorities. It's just detain everybody.
Local law enforcement knows people are scared. While Trump has routinely called for local law enforcement to essentially become de facto ICE agents, that's not their role.
It's not anything that we at the local level are going to be involved with, or have we ever been involved with any immigration issues.
That's Teton County Sheriff Matt Carr. He's trying to project calm.
I mean, I think it's just really try to reassure our local community that local law enforcement's here to support them. We want victims of crime to reach out to us and feel like everybody can reach out to us if they need our help or assistance.
Sheriffs elected to their positions all have to follow the same state and federal laws. But whereas Carr talked about doing the legal minimum to cooperate with ICE, Lincoln County Sheriff Matt Johnson emphasized cooperation with the feds.
I don't anticipate big changes, but certainly we'll cooperate with the federal government in regards to their policies.
So, what's someone without paperwork to do? Gervonis is telling people to plan for being detained.
If you need to call a loved one about bond or about who's picking up your children in the afternoon, having that phone number memorized is important. Having a power of attorney for who's going to take care of your affairs if you are detained is a great idea. Knowing how you're going to access resources like paying a cash bond is also important.
When Gervonis gets a tip that ICE is in town, she sends out alerts to her clients. She takes to Facebook, doing all she can to protect immigrants without interfering with arrests. She noticed that some recent Facebook posts had been censored by Meta. She said her law firm's account was temporarily suspended. It's frustrating for her, but not as frustrating as a system that she sees as benefiting from and profiting off of the same people it punishes.
That was Jenna McMurtry reporting for Jackson Hole Community Radio. She's here with us now. Jenna, since you reported this story, our representative in Washington, D.C., Harriet Hageman, accused the Teton County Sheriff's Office of foiling ICE's attempts to deport undocumented immigrants.
So in a recent newsletter, Hageman claimed that scores of people that were held at the county detention center and could have been deported were released by Teton County Sheriff's Department. And yeah, she claims that a lot of these residents were held on criminal charges, including DUIs, illicit drugs, or sexual violence. Some of these charges could have also been re-entry into the United States after previously being deported.
Okay, and what does the sheriff's office say to that?
So the sheriff kind of disputed that he's, quote, foiling ICE's plans. Sheriff Matt Carr, he confirmed that his department flags ICE every time somebody without documentation comes into the criminal system in Teton County, but he doesn't feel the need to hold people longer for ICE to come pick them up unless there's a warrant signed by a judge.
The Cowboy State Daily reported that
over 100 requests for ICE to pick up folks from Teton County were not honored by Teton County. And Carr says he can't dispute those numbers, but he doesn't know if they're necessarily accurate. That's something we're working on in our newsroom to look into. Carr thinks that holding folks longer than necessary is a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Right, and that's the amendment that protects citizens from unreasonable search and seizures by the government.
Yeah, Carr says he only holds if there is a warrant signed by a judge. And that doesn't typically happen for every single person that's under Teton County custody.
And so where does this leave us now?
With the January legislative session coming up, there's a sanctuary bill on the table that would basically ban any jurisdiction from becoming a sanctuary city for immigrants. Right now, nowhere in Wyoming has that or has really been talking about that. So some folks at the ACLU thinks that this is intended to send a message that Wyoming is an anti-immigrant state. So it'll be interesting to see if that passes and what that response is from immigration advocates. So.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Jenna. I look forward to your reporting on this in the future. Jenna McMurtry with Jackson Hole Community Radio Station on how Wyomingites are anticipating immigration policy changes under Trump. In some pricey corners of the Mountain West, housing has become so expensive that employers are stepping in to help their workers. In Jackson, a state agency has found a way to stretch limited dollars. They're turning to modular homes, which are built in factories. Like Legos, entire sections of the house are assembled on permanent foundations. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach shadows one family from packing up to moving in.
Clark and Danielle Johnson are herding their kids. both under age 5, who are frolicking around their disheveled duplex living room. They're packing up the kitchen stuff and the knickknacks.
All the little random bits and pieces that you don't know which box to throw them in. Yeah, and they'll be
lost forever.
Yeah, the big catch-all boxes.
Clark is a biologist for Wyoming Game and Fish. So his family is moving into the state agency's new modular employee housing. They'll pay the same amount for rent, but it'll be about 3 times as big as this place, which has been pretty cramped for the family of 4 and their 2 wire-haired pointers.
Kind of see everything from where you're standing, but 2 bedrooms, bathroom. We've got kind of just 2 little closets and then a little living room and kitchen.
Knowing their subsidized rental was in the pipeline has kept the Johnsons in Jackson. Like many places in the region, the 10,000-person mountain town has made headlines for housing prices that rival New York City's. So some employers are turning to modular homes to rapidly increase housing stock. They're often bigger than mobile homes and more customizable. That's the sound of a bright orange crane placing half of one of the Game and Fish homes on a foundation back in February. They're split down the middle. 7 houses were built in a factory in northern Idaho and transported here by truck.
I mean, it's the same style of construction as stick built. It just happens to be in a shop.
Lauren Wooden is the chief engineer at Game and Fish.
Temperature controlled environment and guys running around in shorts in the wintertime building stuff instead of being all covered up in Carhartts and dealing with snow all the time.
Wooden says going modular helped address construction worker shortages and speed up the schedule by a couple months. This ended up saving the agency big bucks, over $5 million to be exact, according to the architect and modular home champion of 2 decades, Greg Mason.
Because of bulk construction, the raw materials of lumber and all that stuff, they tend to get a much better deal for all products.
The style still only accounts for under 7% of new commercial and residential buildings in the U.S., according to the Modular Building Institute. But that number has steadily been growing in recent years. Mason says the industry has seen a big boost from the tiny home revolution. Even Tesla and Amazon are breaking into the prefab industry. And the quality has come a long way from your classic 70s double-wide manufactured home.
Everything comes out now with some really nice marble or stone countertops.
In Kemmer, Wyoming, the town is getting almost 90 units trucked in to house workers at a new nuclear plant. And in Colorado, the government is even incentivizing this kind of building. But there's still some pitfalls. It can be harder to save money if you want just one single-family house. Plus, there's still stigmas. Even Danielle Johnson had them at first.
And I was like, oh, what's it going to be like?
I think they're going to look like a trailer house of some sort, which they definitely don't.
Standing in the entryway of their new place, Clark Johnson says it looks like your typical house.
If I hadn't have seen them come in on pieces, I wouldn't really think that they're modulars.
It's the family's first night sleeping there, and the kids are wired. It's a big upgrade. There's the kind of echo that comes from having tall ceilings. Plus 3 bedrooms, a fenced-in backyard, a walk-in pantry, and even a laundry room.
Way, way, way more space than we have been used to being in for the last 8 years.
Now that they're finally in the house, next up, getting the kids to settle into bed and digging out the silverware. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
Up next on Open Spaces, we hear from Miss Wyoming about mental health and brain drain in the state.
The Modern West is resharing our ranching series, The Great Individualist. This time, Bridger and Tom used to think that they had to get big or get out. These days, they've joined the holistic ranching movement.
We kind of came to this type of management because we feel that it's better for the environment.
Only One Bite. It's part 8 of our series, The Great Individualist. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
check out the Wyoming Public Radio Politics Quiz. Are you up to date on the latest state government news? If so, test that knowledge out. In this week's quiz, who will be the next Wyoming Speaker of the House? Think you know the answer? Find out at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click the WPR Politics Quiz tab.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. 21-year-old Bailey Drury is the current Miss Wyoming. She was raised in Grable and is about to graduate from the University of Wyoming with a degree in history. She's also about to represent the Equality State in the Miss America competition in Orlando, Florida at the start of the new year. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman chatted with Drury about sports, mental health, and what a day in the life of Miss Wyoming is actually like.
Basically, a day in the life of Miss Wyoming on Tuesdays and Thursdays is waking up at 5:30, doing my morning preparation, and then going to school from 9 to 5. I am always traveling as Miss Wyoming. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, that is my prime time, being Miss Wyoming, on the job all the time. An interesting fact about being Miss Wyoming is in the month of June, I was only laying in my bed 7 days out of the entire month. I was traveling the rest of the days, but I'm super grateful for it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so...
You played on your high school football team. You are a wrestling team captain, and you've got your campaign called Support Girls and Women in Sports. For you, what's the role of sports in a thriving community?
Absolutely. So I always played sports growing up. As far as I can remember, I was always playing a sport. So I was actually born in California, moved here when I was 13 years old. So that would have been my eighth grade year of middle school. And with that, I lost a sense of community, and through sports was the way that I could find community again. I had horrible struggles with bullying all through high school, so it was really important to me to find outlets outside of school so that I can have friends, I can feel accomplished, move my body. The role of sports for me was really providing a sense of safety, and I think that's the same for a lot of the girls that I coach as well.
Let's talk a little bit about mental health. Both Miss USA and Miss Teen USA resigned from their roles earlier this year, citing mental health challenges. Has this role for you as Miss Wyoming had any impacts on your mental health? And do you think pageants need to change at all to better support the health of the contestants?
So first thing I do want to clarify is that Miss USA and Miss America are two separate entities, but I do not shy away from this question at all. I just want to clarify that those are two different organizations. And ultimately, we are all human beings. And I think sometimes that gets lost when you have girls getting on stage who are extremely gorgeous, extremely talented, and we're expected to be perfect all of the time. And I think that can be really, really challenging. In the case of the Miss USA girls that stepped down, that is their decision, and we as a community need to support that 100%. When I was growing up, a Miss USA, Chesley Christ, actually committed suicide, citing mental health issues, and she was actually a very big role model to me. And a part of losing her made everybody take a step back and go, what do we do to support these strong and independent women? Because I think a part of pageantry is, one, we portray out to the world that we have all of our ducks in a row, right? But we also are human too. And sometimes you get knocked back a couple of steps, and that's okay. And I think we as a pageant community need to start embracing that.
What are the ways that you're trying to advocate for better mental health in your role?
What I do with all of my teams, the first day of practice, I give them a piece of paper asking them what their names are, what their favorite color, what's their favorite snack. But then at the end, I say, are you experiencing bullying or mental health problems? I fully acknowledge that some of the girls are probably not going to be open and honest on that paper, but I hope that through that piece of paper that I give them on the first day of practice, that they know, my coach is somebody that I could come to if I decide to open up about it.
From your perspective as a University of Wyoming student, what is the school doing well to support students on campus? And what do you think it could be doing better or differently?
I am somebody who has, since I came here, utilized the counseling, the free counseling that we have on campus. Us college students don't have a lot of money, and I'm right there with you. I understand that. So to be able to have free counseling and just feel like this is not a burden on my family, this isn't a burden on myself, I think that's really beautiful and something that we should talk about more. Something that we can do better, I think we just need to be advertising more. I think students need to know it's not a failure to say, hey, I'm struggling. And that's really hard to get over, especially in the Cowboy State where we persevere through anything. And that's something beautiful about our state. We also just need to advertise more as much as possible. Hey, we have these resources and it's okay to say I'm not okay.
Switching gears a little bit, there's been a lot of concern about young people leaving Wyoming and not coming back. What do you think could help prevent this so-called brain drain in the state?
One of the things that I love about our state is our financial aid to our school systems. I am writing on most scholarships for my whole entire academic career in college. And so I haven't really had to pay that much out of pocket. And if we want to keep kids in the state, then we need to provide for them financially to be able to get the degrees that they want. I think also another thing is that we need to create more jobs in the state of Wyoming, that when our kids and when our students graduate with this degree that they have fought so hard for, that they're not looking out of state, because out of state pays better, has better benefits, has better communities for their kids to grow up in a safe environment or have good schooling opportunities, whatever the case may be. There is a before graduation problem of keeping our students in the state of Wyoming, but also we need to keep our young adults in the state of Wyoming. And I believe that's through jobs.
Going off of that, do you plan to stay in Wyoming after graduation? And what sort of future do you hope for here for yourself?
I know that right after graduation, I probably won't be staying here in Wyoming, but that is because I have decided that the path for me is to become a JAG in the United States Air Force, which is a lawyer in the United States Air Force. So that will most likely be leading me to travel. However, I do know that Wyoming has my heart, and Wyoming is a place that I believe is so beneficial to raise a family. So I know that coming back to Wyoming is going to be in my deck of cards for sure.
Before we sign off, anything else you'd like to add?
I think what's so beautiful about the Miss America opportunity is we want to create strong leaders of tomorrow, and that is through education. Every girl who stepped off the Miss Wyoming stage this year stepped off the stage with a scholarship. I think if this is something you might be interested in, give us a chance. Let us try and get you to come back. And yeah, I think it's a beautiful opportunity to make friends and just be a leader in your community. So look us up for sure.
I've been talking with Bailey Drury. She is Miss Wyoming and a student at the University of Wyoming. Bailey, thanks so much for talking today.
Thank you for having me.
Drury will represent Wyoming in the Miss America competition in Orlando, Florida at the start of the new year. Like Drury said, it's okay to ask for help when you're struggling. You can call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Only about 1 in 10 construction workers are women, and less than 1 in 100 have hands-on jobs in the field. Many younger girls think that business isn't for them, but some construction leaders in our region want women to see the breadth and depth of the industry firsthand. KUNC's Emma Vandenende reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
A big yellow crane is powered up at the Jefferson County Fairgrounds. Seventh grader Khadijah Talib from Lesher Middle School in Fort Collins steps up into the seat to learn how to use it. She grabs the controls and swings the crane's arm to hit a soccer ball.
That looks good. Goal.
Perfect.
Talib is one of 1,700 girls from across the Front Range that came on a Thursday morning to the annual Transportation and Construction Girl Day, an event set up by women for women to encourage girls to not knock the business before they try it. Talib says this is unlike any field trip she's been on before.
It's like interactive. Like, it's not like a classroom or something where like they just teach us. We like actually get to try some of the things out.
The event featured nearly 70 interactive exhibits. from operating a crane to drilling in a piece of plywood. They could even try their hand at welding. This event has some of the girls thinking about what classes they should take in high school, or even what career to pursue in college. Talib is still on the fence about construction. She doesn't like all the loud noises, but she feels like the profession is more open to her.
It's just that men do it a lot. I feel like it's a men's kind of job, like lots of people think that, but I feel like a lot of women would like to do it too.
Last year, there were around 4,000 women doing a hands-on construction or extraction job in Colorado, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's less than 0.5% of the entire craft industry in the state. Keller Hayes is the founder of Transportation and Construction Girl. She has some theories on the low numbers. She says when construction industries would visit schools in previous years, there wasn't female representation.
We would send someone who was ready to retire who would also be male. And so the girls would sort of sit back in the back of the room and go, well, okay, that doesn't have anything to do with me.
Even when women tried construction, the stereotypes around it could hold them back. Maya Rosenquist remembers how she was treated when she started out in the industry around 30 years ago.
The questions were largely centered around, are you going to cut it in this industry? Like, how are you going to handle yourself versus, you know, who are you? What are your skills?
Rosenquist is now the senior vice president of Mortenson, and she's worked on diversifying Mortenson's workforce. The latest numbers show 11% of their hands-on workers are women. But she wants to get that number higher, especially considering there's a shortage of construction workers. She says more women would join if they just were informed about the variety of jobs. That was the case for Sila Martinez. She says she became a major rock hound when she was only 5 years old. She thought collecting rocks was just a fun hobby, until she participated in a career week with a construction company.
I had realized, oh my goodness, there's so much more that goes into this. There's the design phase, there's the groundwork, there's the engineering and the ingenuity that just goes into these projects.
Martinez is now a senior at the Colorado School of Mines, and she's on track to become a geotechnical engineer. She wants to do soil analysis on construction sites, and she's happy to show her friends that the business can be so much more than leveling concrete or digging holes.
As long as we can educate them and kind of tell them, hey, this is actually what it is, then they start to realize, oh my God, that's actually super cool.
As the Transportation and Construction Girl Day comes to a close, the girls from Lesher Middle School are already brainstorming the array of jobs they can choose from. Avery W. says she wants to build tiny homes.
I'd probably like doing drywall because my dad builds tiny houses, so I would like to do that too. That sounds fun.
No matter the direction, that's the spark that women construction leaders want to keep lighting for the generation to come. Emma Vandenhainde, KUNC.
Next, we head up to the northwest part of the state to look at impacts tourism and higher cost of living has in those communities. This is Open Spaces.
It is a joy to have Wyoming news, to enjoy Wyoming kind of music directed to a Wyoming type of culture, familiar voices.
I think Wyoming is lucky to have this. I think Wyoming appreciates it, and I think it's been supported in ways that testify to that.
Those were two brothers, Al and Pete. They made testimonials in appreciation of Wyoming Public Radio. You can join Al and Pete Simpson with a testimonial of your own. It's easy, and you can get the hang of it by going to our website and finding out more about our I Love Wyoming Public Radio campaign. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and join the folks who are letting their voices be heard.
Join me, Fiona Ritchie, for a walk near my home. We'll share songs, tunes, and seasonal tales, and take in the scenes of midwinter in a special Thistle and Shamrock Christmas.
Sunday night, December 22nd at 8 o'clock on Wyoming Public Radio.
This is Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The Regulatory Reduction Task Force was formed in 2023 to make Wyoming a more business-friendly state, limiting regulations on oil and gas, mining, agricultural, and construction. But housing issues quickly rose to the top of its agenda. Now, with the new legislative session beginning next month, there's expected turnover in the group, and a meeting last month sputtered when not enough legislators showed up. A separate meeting planned for this month was canceled. According to Senator Mike Guru, a Jackson Democrat, the dysfunction meant the opportunity to move four draft bills closer to becoming actual bills failed. In a conversation with Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula-Ankeny, he says that the future of the bills and the group as a whole are unclear to him.
Today we're talking about the Regulatory Reduction Task Force, a group formed last year that you co-chair. I wonder if you could tell me what your experience has been on this task force.
Well, yeah, great question. I think the governor was very interested in this and trying to just look wherever we could find in state government where regulations was hurting business or slowing or stifling or just getting in the way. But a lot of it is kind of centered around housing and try to get housing, whether it be affordable housing or quality housing or what have you.
Yeah, why did the group focus on housing?
Well, it's just, you know, like I say, in the rest of the state, you know, depending on where you are in the state of Wyoming, housing is a problem. But it's just different problems in different areas. In a lot of communities, it's about quality housing. There might be some housing stock, but it might be old, outdated. And when you're trying to get new businesses to come, you got to have a certain quality of housing to try to attract businesses and companies. We seem kind of wanting in that area. I'm, of course, in Teton County. It's a little bit different. Some of the challenges there are different.
Yeah, I wonder if you feel like the Regulatory Reduction Task Force has taken an unfair look at Teton County.
Well, you know, I'd never say the work of a task force, especially this task force that I'm the co-chair of, was unfair. I think a fundamental misunderstanding and a fundamental lack of understanding of some of the issues that Teton County faces and the differences between that and the rest of the state, and what may sound onerous in other parts of the state where the land values aren't quite the same, where some of the challenges are not the same. I have to understand. Take my district, my Senate district. Over 98% of my Senate district is owned by the federal government, which means less than 2% of my district can be developed.
Four bills discussed at your guys' last meeting in November. In that meeting, legislators failed to make a quorum, and no official decision was made on those four bills. I wonder, do you think that these four bills should be introduced in the next legislative session?
I have not seen what tweaks my co-chair has in mind. There's some of those bills I don't think are ready. I do think, I'm going to be honest with you and the folks at home, I think they're a little bit focused more in a punitive way against Teton County. That having been said, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a good, robust discussion. But I also think those robust discussions on what Teton County is doing are best held in Teton County by the town and by the county. Got a good set of county commissioners. We got a great set of town council members. And you know what? I have a lot of faith in them. I supported a lot of them, and I still do. And so I like to kind of leave that in their bailiwick because that's where it should reside. Chairman Nicholas said he might carry them as personal bills. And this, once again, this is something that happens at the end of one session going to another where kind of the clock's running out. And so sometimes the legislators will say, I'm going to take that bill as a personal bill and try to run it because the committee isn't just going to meet in time and have a chance to make it a committee bill. That's important for your listeners because committee bills make it through the legislature at about 70% of the time. An individual bill passes about 20% of the time. So committee, and that's just because committee bills are usually worked longer through an interim, and we do this back and forth. So by the time it gets out, it's kind of been vetted. These four bills here at the end haven't had that many opportunities to get vetted. So it may be they end up on the personal route anyway, or we could wait and see and have the, if the leadership of the incoming, the 68th legislature decides to keep the task force moving, whether I'm on it or not, or whether Bob's on it or not, it'd keep it moving and keep those bills running forward. It'll be their choice to make. But as far as what happened at the last meeting, we also kind of run into another problem, and that is we're at the end of one session. The 67th legislature, which is a two-year session, is ending. This committee and its work is ending. It'll be up to the 68th legislature and the leaders who've just been elected to decide if the Regulatory Reduction Task Force will move forward. And if so, what they're going to discuss and who the membership is going to be. Those discussions haven't taken place. So here we are in December, and we had a meeting, and we just, when we get anywhere near the holidays, it just happens. Folks get busy. So they didn't have a quorum. They talked about some issues. They set a meeting for December 5th. Also terrible time because of holidays and all that. Plus an extra added issue was we didn't have the money budgeted for from the management council of the legislature to have another meeting. And so now we've got two problems. One, we've got to ask the management council for money for another meeting and then try to put it together. My co-chair, Bob Nicholas from Cheyenne, a gifted legislator, went ahead and set the meeting, but we hadn't done the other two parts yet. Come to find it was very difficult once again to try to get folks there. And then also we had to go, we would have put ourselves in a position to go off to ask management council to have them have another meeting to appropriate money to us to have another meeting. All of that together, it just kind of got bogged down by its own weight.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, Mike, personally, what do you think the future is of the task force at large?
Well, I think the task force has merit. It's not all bad. There's some good ideas out there. And we might need some more time to explore them. And I think one of the things I've learned in the Regulatory Reduction Task Force is Wyoming is pretty good at not overregulating.
Great, Mike. Well, I appreciate you taking this interview on such short notice, and I hope to talk in the future.
All right. Thanks a lot. Merry Christmas. Take care.
That was Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula Ankeny talking with Jackson Democrat Senator Mike Guru about the future of the Regulatory Reduction Task Force. Tourism is becoming an increasingly important part of Wyoming's economy. Cody has the benefit of also being a gateway town to Yellowstone National Park, but it hasn't quite kept up with other gateway towns. For decades, the county's tourism agency marketed dude ranch vacations, the local rodeo, and the area's cowboy history. But lately, the Park County Travel Council has highlighted more outdoors experiences. It's a shift backed by millions of local lodging tax dollars, but it's drawn skepticism from some locals. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats spoke with Ryan Hauk, who's been heading the effort.
Ryan, I wanted to ask you, what's something special about Park County that sets it apart? What's something unique that you can do when you come here?
What really blew me away when I came here is the outdoors that we have. 80% public lands. The fishing here is insane year round. The hiking is unlimited. The forest is called the Horse Forest because it has the most equestrian trails than anywhere else in the country. You know, snowmobiling is not just the best for the area, it's some of the best in the country. No place that I've ever lived or even visited has the amount of world-class outdoor recreation than what we have here.
For a lot of years, Park County advertised itself as the place where you could get the authentic Western experience. We're talking dude ranches, history museums, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you're taking a different tack with your marketing strategy. Explain to us kind of what kind of tourists that you're trying to get to come to Cody Yellowstone.
So we still promote our authentic Western experiences kind of at the forefront. But you're 100% right in that, you know, we definitely have kind of a secondary scheme to our marketing with our outdoor recreation. And specifically trying to hit that millennial market a little bit harder than what we have in the past. Obviously, you know, the boomer market has been great for us for years. To this day, they're still the ones that spend the most money when they come here, which is always great. But as that market starts to age out and we start to see new travelers come through looking for more of those experiential type things, we want to make sure that we're appealing to that market and you know, enticing them to come here.
So you talked about that older audience that typically comes to Cody. You know, obviously they're aging. But tell us more about why this shift towards showcasing the county in a more outdoorsy way.
So we don't just throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. We use something called Zartico. It's a mobile tracking platform. And that showcases that people's number one reason they want to come here is not even Yellowstone most months. It actually is all of our outdoor recreation.
And so, outdoor recreation being, can you list some of those things?
It could be wildlife watching from their windows. It could be fishing. It could be going on hikes. It could be kind of what I call lunch loops, something that you could do in a couple hours, you know, straight from town here.
I talked to Jennifer Toma at the Chamber, and she says there's some confusion among locals about this update in marketing strategy to include more of the outdoors part of, and the recreation part in the strategy, you know, besides just the history and the dude ranches. And she says that she'd like to see more transparency and local involvement in shaping these campaigns. And I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
What's tough for us is that our target is not locals. And so everything we do campaign-wise and all this work we do, locals never get to see it, unfortunately, because obviously we're trying to push this stuff out to non-residents. So, and I agree with her, and it's stuff that the board and I have talked about as well in the past. So, you know, we are going to be putting together a local PR strategy that really just, you know, might show up in the form of like an editorial in the Cody Enterprise, Pal Tribune, and maybe with Janet Jones and her Cody Journal as well.
What do you think people are most confused about?
I think it's really what our office does. You know, some people say, we're the East Gate of Yellowstone, Ryan. People are going to come no matter what. You know, we don't need to do any marketing. You know, it might dip down a little bit, but I think what we have is good enough to get people here. Or we don't need tourism. I hear that sometimes too. We don't need tourism, right? We have plenty of stuff just that our locals can support. And so I think it's educating people, you know, what we do. How does it affect who is coming here and how they're coming here. There's some very popular examples out there of people having that same sentiment in other destinations. The DMO got voted out, and that next year is atrocious, and they lost.
The DMO, what is that?
Destination Marketing Organization.
That's, got it.
That's
Park
what
County
we are.
Travel Council.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yep.
So in other destinations, they lost that marketing arm, and they saw massive, massive dips. Typically, when a DMO gets voted out, the next year, typically, the lodging tax will pass by 80 to 90% because locals will see the effect immediately. Now, why that's bad is because to get that organization back, not only do they now have to play catch-up, but they now have to get you back up to snuff where everybody else is at. And so you lose years and years of progress just based off of that 1 year's decision.
In recent years, tourism to other gateway towns has really taken off. I think of Bozeman, Jackson, West Yellowstone. So Teton County, where Jackson is, they're getting close to $2 billion in annual visitor spending. Looking back the last decades, theirs has gone up 80%. Park County has increased by 37%. So obviously some increases in Park County, but not to the extent that some of these other Yellowstone gateways are seeing. And I just wanted to get your take on like why that might be.
Sure. So you have to look at cost of the things that visitors spend money on. So for example, you brought up Jackson. Do you know what the average hotel is in Jackson? It's over double what ours is. So you have to look at what visitors spend money on to really put those numbers in retrospect of what you're actually seeing.
Yeah. So obviously going out to dinner costs more in Jackson. But yeah, are there any other reasons why, you know, why maybe? And again, I know that you've only been in this role for 3 years. Like, you know, I'm talking I'm talking numbers from the past decade.
What somebody did before I was in this role is a tough thing to answer. It was a different board. It was a different director. I really couldn't tell you what their scheme was, back way before I got here. But I can tell you post-COVID, since I've taken over in 2021, we've seen 807,000 overnight visitors in 21 to 984,000 in 2023. We see millions of dollars coming here, increasing every single year since 2021. It's been not just organic growth, it's been expedited growth over the past, 3.5-4 years for us. So I think we actually have a lot going on, and the way that these other destinations have grown compared to the way that we have grown might affect some of that visitor spend. Obviously, you see Bozeman with all their air service that they have, and the diversification of the businesses that are popping up there with tech and medical and everything else.
I'm wondering, so how will you know if this branding shift is successful, and what will that look like for the public?
Yep. So I already know. like I said, it's been running for about 3.5 years. I think a marketing campaign for it to truly see if it is going to be successful, it needs about a year or two under its belt to see if it's moving the needle, right? And so now we've had a few years of this thing happening. 807,000 visitors in 2021, 984,000.
Overnight, that's overnight visitors?
Overnight visitors, that's right. To 984,000 overnight visitors in 2023. It's working. Our destination is like I mentioned before, really running on all cylinders. Our destination sentiment is there. Our campaign is working. Our website visits have gone up through the roof. Our SEO, our SEM, our regional, our national. I mean, everything is working right now. And so we are looking forward to continued success and, ready to keep this thing going.
Okay, it sounds like you're feeling optimistic.
I am, yeah. Should be a really good year.
Ryan, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Ryan Houck. He's the executive director of the Park County Travel Council. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Scientists studying Mars are looking for clues about the landscape much closer to home. Coming up, we'll hear how scientists are using the Colorado River to understand the surface of the red planet. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Every day, Wyoming Public Radio brings you the news, from the latest on the war in Ukraine to ongoing issues of climate change, energy, and the economy. Tune in for what's happening here in Wyoming, around the Mountain West, and beyond, with state and regional news updates during Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered. And you can find the latest news anytime at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Stay informed with Wyoming Public Radio.
Hello, listeners. This is Megan Feary. And this time on Human Nature, a woman's deep love for animals sparks her to take action.
I was invited to raise some wolf puppies, and I don't know about you, but my immediate reaction was drop everything. Yes, how often do you get that opportunity in life? So I dropped everything and helped raise 7 wolf puppies.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Put a picture of the Grand Canyon next to one of Mars, and it's easy to see some similarities. Red rock formations dominate both landscapes. But just how closely related are the places carved by the Colorado River and the surface of the red planet? KUNC's Ray Solomon talked to scientists trying to figure that out.
For centuries, science has studied Mars, the only planet where life may exist.
Maybe it's the intriguing red color, or because it's one of the brightest points of light in the night sky. But us Earthlings have always been drawn to the planet Mars.
Here is the suspense, the surprise, drama of the unknown. Flight to Mars!
Hydrologist Lin Ji is no exception. The University of Arizona researcher and freshly minted PhD usually studies the lower Colorado River Basin, solidly grounded on Earth. But a few years ago, she became fascinated by satellite images of the red planet. And that's why she noticed something interesting looking down at Arizona's Santa Cruz River out her airplane window.
And I thought, oh, this Santa Cruz River system look exactly the same to the Martian valleys. They both have like a tree-like branching river systems.
That observation sparked a big idea that eventually made its way into her dissertation.
I realized that there could be a connection between the Earth river system and the Mars Valley network.
A connection that spans 140 million miles through the cold, dark vacuum of outer space.
They share similar characteristics, which indicate that they could have a similar climate.
For the lower Colorado, that means an arid climate, where rain is rare but heavy when it comes, and flash flooding is so powerful it can carve up a landscape. That doesn't sound much like the Mars we know and love today, all cold and ice-capped with a surface mostly devoid of liquid water. But those Martian valleys are billions of years old. Back then, the planet was warm and water was plentiful. Research suggests it also had flash flooding.
We infer that the formation of the valley networks on Mars is also formed by high-intensity rainfall.
Just like the lower Colorado. But University of Colorado Boulder geologist Lon Abbott says river basins are not shaped by flash flooding alone. There are so many overlapping forces, geologic structures, and ice age cycles that are also important.
It's a really complex interplay of different factors that have different time scales, and the morphology that you see is the combination of all of those.
He says that complexity makes it hard to compare the two planets in a straightforward way.
I'm not sure that we could argue with confidence that 3.5 billion years ago on Mars was more similar to the climate that we see today in the lower Colorado River Basin.
The beauty of Gee's work is that she deployed sophisticated computer modeling to cut through that complexity. And if she's right about the Martian climate, Scott Hubbard says that could resolve one of humanity's all-time biggest obsessions.
Was Mars habitable? Was it an environment that if life emerged, it would be able to live long and prosper?
As the first director of NASA's Mars program, Hubbard spent his career looking into that question.
Understanding how the climate evolved over time would tell us a lot about if life did form where it might be today.
He says humans could be just a few years away from putting feet on Martian ground. And if looking at the Colorado River Basin can help us anticipate where life still exists on that distant planet, it could be the key to a successful mission.
Amazing underground Martian cities, a planet of wonders.
Ray Solomon, KUNC.
This story was produced by KUNC in collaboration with the Water Desk at the University of Colorado Boulder. Funding for KUNC's water coverage comes from the Walton Family Foundation. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, today's audio producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and thanks to Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.